धाम वृंदावनम आराध्यो भगवान ब्रजेश तनयस् तद्धाम वृंदावन रम्या काचिदुपासनया कल्पिता रम्या काचिदुपासना ब्रजवधूवर्गेण या कल्पिता श्रीमद्भागवतम् प्रमाणममलम् प्रेमापुमर्थो महान् श्रीमद्भागवतम् प्रमाणममलम् प्रेमापुमर्थो महान् श्रीचैतन्यमहाप्रभुर्मतमिदम् तत्रादरो न परा श्रीचैतन्यमहाप्रभुर्मतमिदम् तत्रादरो न परा. So this one verse is a encapsulation, it's a summary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. Right? Someone asks you, well, what is your philosophy? What is it that makes Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy distinctive? What are the cornerstones, the pillars of his philosophy? Then he gives it all in this one very nice verse. It begins like this. Aradhyo Bhagavan Vrajesha Tanaya. Right? Our worshipable Lord, Aradhya, is Vrajesha Tanaya, the son of the king of Braj, which is Krishna. So, this is carefully chosen words, right? It's important that he didn't say just Krishna, because he's specifying which Krishna. Our primary object of love and attachment and affection is Krishna as the son of Maharaj Nanda. So not Krishna the king, Krishna the son of the king. In other words, Krishna in this form of intimacy, not power and awe and reverence, but as Damodar, basically. Conquered by the love of his devotees. So, first thing, this is who we worship. Aradhyo Bhagavan Brajesha Tanayas. Then, location, address. Taddhama Vrindavanam. And his abode, his location, is Sri Vrindavan Dham. So, Krishna, the son of Maharaj Nanda, located in the holiest of places, Sri Vrindavan. That's the spiritual geographical center of our movement. Then, Ramya Kachidupasana Vrajavadhu Vargena Ya Kalpita. The most pleasing form of worship to Lord Krishna, Ramya, that which he appreciates the most. Kachid upasana vrajavadhu vargena ya kalpita is that worship which is done in the footsteps, in the path, vargena ya kalpita, of brajavadhu, of the gopis, of the ladies of Vrindavan. Okay. In their mood, following in their footsteps, that bhakti which is performed, that is the highest and most pleasing to Lord Krishna. Then, Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam. Where do we get all of this from? Where do we come up with this idea from? Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam. Srimad Bhagavata is the spotless Pramana. Pramana means the source of knowledge. And we've already discussed at length what makes the Bhagavatam so pure and spotless as a Pramana. So that's our source of knowledge, where we're getting our information from, our authority. Prema Pumartho Mahan. And the goal which we're working toward is Prema. Prema Pumartho Mahan. So Purushartha. Pumartha means the same as Purushartha. So Prema is called the Panchama Purushartha, the fifth human goal. Okay, so the four we've already talked about, Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha. So the fifth one is Panchama Purushartha, is Prema, pure love for Krishna. That's where we're going. So the verse lays it out very clearly. Who we worship, how we get there, what our goal is once we get there, where are we going, right? All location, address, method, it's all there, conveyance. And he says, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhur Matamidam. This is the viewpoint, the opinion, the doctrine of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Tatra Daro Napara. Nothing else beyond this. Hare Krishna. That's someone is on the phone from Richmond. They're listening in. So they must have pressed a button. So this is the viewpoint of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? Beautiful, beautiful. Just one verse, you can memorize it, and it'll give you a handy summary always. And you often find Prabhupada in his lectures, he quote a line here or a line there from it whenever he's wanting to make a specific point out of this list of four or five ideas or points. So Bhagavatam is there, right there, as kind of pramanam amalam, the spotless source of knowledge that's there. Now, we were discussing of what makes Bhagavatam the highest or the topmost source of knowledge. And we talked about things like context, and we talked about things like its ease of understanding, its accessibility, and so on. And it's the purity of its content, giving up all other kinds of cheating religion. But there's also some more kind of hands-on, direct ways in which the Bhagavatam is very advanced or elevated. You see, Bhagavatam is considered a Purana. It's in the body of literature that are known as Puranas. And Purana basically means ancient histories, right? The Purana means very old. It gives ancient knowledge. And the Puranas have a typical style about them in which they convey this knowledge, one of conversational style. So I ask a question, you give me the answer, and that, and then I ask another question, you give me. And in this way, the conversation kind of meanders from one place to another. So we see that Bhagavatam is a Purana. Shukadev Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit, Suta Goswami and Shonaka Rishi, and they're asking each other questions. And every once in a while, Parikshit Maharaj will stop and say, oh, hold on, what did you say there? What was that? And can you expand on that? And Parikshit Maharaj said, oh, yeah, that reminds me of a conversation that happened between Maitreya Muni and Vidur, and then like that. So yes, it's a Purana. But the thing about Bhagavatam is that just from a very kind of textual perspective, it's so much more than just a Purana. It breaks boundaries of any kind of specific type or genre of literature, and you can't really characterize it so well. For one thing, the Bhagavata has a level of philosophy that is practically unparalleled. It is unparalleled amongst the Puranas and amongst most kinds of Shastic literature. The philosophical level presented in the Bhagavatam is very deep. It's very sophisticated. Most of the Puranas, they present a rather simple theology or simple philosophy. You know, basic ideas. Do this, don't do this, do bhakti like that, and so on. But Bhagavatam is a 100% Vedantic text, meaning the depths of knowledge that you find in, say, Vedanta Sutra or the Upanishads, you'll find it all there in Bhagavatam plus more. Just take a look at the first verse of Bhagavatam. Janmadyasya yatonvayadi taratascharteshvabhignya swarat tene brahma hridaya adikavaye muhyanti yat suraya tejo varimridam yatha vinimayo yatra trisargo mrisha dhamna svena sada nirastakuhakam satyam param dhimahi. Just to explain that one verse would take 3 hours. It's very, very complicated. What it is basically, it's almost like a string of different sutras all combined together. It begins, janmadyase yataha. Janmadyase yataha. Anvayat itaratas charteshu abhigya swarat. All those words, so difficult to explain. And such deep in meaning. If we have time near the end of this seminar, then I'll give you some kind of explanations from Jiva Goswami into how he explains that first verse. In fact, Jiva Goswami finds the meaning of the first 5 sutras of Vedanta Sutra present within that first verse. Okay, all 5 sutras are explained. The first sutra, you know, is the first sutra of Vedanta Sutra, Atato Brahma Jignyasa. Now, therefore, let us inquire into the absolute truth. Second sutra, Janmadyasyata. What is that absolute truth? That from which everything emanates, in whom it rests, and at the end, who dissolves it all. Okay. Then, Shastra Yonitvat, okay. Tattu Samanvayat, Ikshate Nashabdam. These 5 sutras, the meaning is found within the first verse of Bhagavatam. Jiva Goswami explains that first verse in order to prove that the Bhagavatam is in fact the best commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. He does it with the first verse and shows how the meaning of the first verse contains the meaning of these first 5 sutras. And then he stops after that and he says, okay, now you can do the rest if you want to. Right? But his main point is, now that I've shown that Bhagavatam contains the meaning of all the Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra, so don't worry about all of that. Just study Bhagavatam. Right? That's enough. That's his main point. So philosophically speaking, it's very sophisticated and even very difficult at times. My brother, for example, he's doing his PhD now in Oxford on the concept of Maya in Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's so much there, so much detail and so much, elaborate. But it's not just a work of philosophy either. On top of that, it's a work of exquisite poetry. In other words, most works of philosophy that you read are not very poetic in nature. They're pretty dry. You could read any, pick up any, you know, philosophy book, Eastern or Western. It's going to be pretty plodding. You have to be well awake and determined in order to get through it. Works of poetry, on the other hand, often appeal very strongly to our emotions and feelings and environment, but you know, they're not interested in the systematic delineation of some idea or concept. Bhagavatam is both a work of very advanced philosophy, and at the same time, it's one of the most beautiful pieces of poetry in all of Indian literature. And this is not just coming from a devotee's perspective. This is, in fact, academics and scholars, anyone who reads it. There's one very famous professor at the University of Chicago who was one of the best Sanskritists in the first generation of scholars who studied this type of thing in the United States. His name was Daniel Ingalls. And he was kind of the guru, so to speak, of many of the professors of Sanskrit who teach today in the U.S. And he said very openly that I've never come across a piece of poetry more beautiful than Bhagavata anywhere. Just period. This was his experience. And he's not even from India, what to speak of, you know. So the Bhagavatam has verses, for example, meters, different types of metrical verses that are not found anywhere else before the Srimad Bhagavatam. Since then, people have used them. But Bhagavatam is first in providing them. And a beautiful variety of different verses. Most of the Puranas, when they tell their stories, is just in the simple Anushtubh verse. You know these verses from Bhagavad Gita, the short ones. Dharma Kshetre, Kurukshetre, Samaveta, Yuyutsava, Mamaka, Pandava. It's 8 syllables per line. Dharma Kshetre, Kurukshetre, Samaveta, Yuyutsava, Mamaka, Pandavaschaiva, Kim Akur Vata Sanjaya. So 32 syllables, 8 syllables per line. And this is standard, and it's the easiest one to compose in. If you get a little bit more complicated, then you get 11 or 12 syllables per line. This is called Trishtub. This happens at particularly impressive moments within the Gita. So when Arjuna surrenders to Krishna for the first time, becomes his disciple, it changes the length of the verse. Have you noticed? Karpanya dosho pahata swabhava prichami tvam dharma samudacheta. That's much longer. If you count it, it's more than 8 syllables per line. Or when Vishwarupa is being shown, the cosmic form, then it's all long verses. Everyone's feeling very amazed. So that's the extent you get in Puranas, Itihasas, Mahabharata, Ramayana. It's all that length. Bhagavatam, on the other hand, uses a wide range of beautiful meters, and some of them are completely new to the Bhagavata. So the very first verse makes this clear. In these first three verses, Bhagavatam already uses 2 meters, and neither one of them are the standard meters that the Puranas use. So it's right off the bat, it's saying, look, I'm different. This is not the same as what you've got. The first one, Janmadhyasya Tonvaya, this verse, is called Shardula Vikriditam, this meter, which means the play of a tiger. The play of a tiger. And this meter is like that. It's the same chanda as Shad Goswami Ashtaka. Krishnot Kirtanaka Janmadhyasya Yatonvaya Ditaratas Chartheshvabhignya. And it's very rhythmy, very nice. It's like someone is playing, it's lively, but someone with a heavy step, a tiger playing. Janmadhyasya Yatonvaya Ditaratas. Like that. And then, Nigamakalpataror Galitam Phalam, yet another meter. And like this, the Bhagavatam has so many different beautiful meters. This one in the 10th canto with the gopis singing, right, that we like repeating so much, and we hear tapes and cassettes of it. Tavakathamritam taptajivanam kavibhiriditam kalmashapaham shavanamangalam srimadatatam bhuvigrinanti ye bhuridajana. Right? Such a beautiful, beautiful meter. This is called Rajahamsi, the king swan, the king of swans, right? Specific type. And it's very regal, like a swan, you know, you can imagine. It kind of meanders. Tava kathamritam taptajivanam kaviviriritam. In the manner of a swan, the way a swan moves, neck held high in a very graceful back and forth sort of manner. This is unique to Bhagavatam, right? Beautiful meter. And especially in the 10th canto, you get a variety of different exquisite types of poetry. And not just the meter, but also the language. These verses of Bhagavatam, they're so sophisticated in their language and so beautiful. It's like music to the ears, just the different ways of expressing. So many verses in Bhagavatam, you'll get different kinds of analogies, different words that are used all throughout the verse that you have to translate in one way, but they're hinting or suggesting at something else. Just like there's this one verse in Jayan Vijay's, when Jayan Vijay stop the four Kumaras, okay, then the four Kumaras get angry and they criticize Jayan Vijay. They say, "You are living here in Vaikuntha and yet you're seeing differences or distinctions, classifications between people, when there should be no differences or everyone should be equal here in Vaikuntha." And that's the meaning. That's how you have to translate. But if you read the Sanskrit there, there's words where when they say everyone is born from the Supreme Lord, right? And yet you see differences. And the word they use in all those verses are all have to do with the womb, the imagery of the womb. We all come from the womb of the Supreme Lord, and yet you are seeing differences of womb. And every word that's used is building on that imagery of the womb, right? And in this way, they're hinting also at caste and different caste distinctions and saying, if you see differences based on the womb, namely where you're born from, then this is not right in the bhakti of the Lord, right? So many different layers of meaning, which in order to get it, you have to like translate the verse three different ways in order to get the full range of meaning, because you cannot express it in one go, right? So there's plenty of puns, metaphors, alliteration, the language, the sound of the words. Just like this verse Prabhupada quotes, Tad vag visargo janataga viplavo. Right? It's got so much alliteration to it. Vag visargo viplavo. All using the word va, va, va like that in different forms. There's so many words they could use, but they use words that are beautiful to the ear. When Mother Yashoda is churning, then the words that it's using, they sound like ting, 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 like that. You know, it's Bhagavatam, when it says it, it doesn't just say it. It says it in such a way that you can actually hear the spiritual world. And that's why Prabhupada says, even if you don't understand the meaning, but just reciting these verses, it'll give so much benefit, because it's actually sound vibration directly from the spiritual world. So, poetry, philosophy, language, its vocabulary is one of the most difficult in Sanskrit. There are words that you find in Bhagavatam that you don't find anywhere else in Sanskrit literature, anywhere. So if you look up the word in the dictionary, it'll give you the meaning, and then it'll quote the verse from Bhagavatam, which is the only place it's found. And then you wonder, how do they know the meaning then? Right? If you know the meaning of the word, this is book, I say book, right? And you say, well, how do you know what the word book means? Well, it's by looking at multiple cases. If I say this is a book, and that's a book, and that's a book, then you understand, oh, okay, some pages bound together, oh, that means a book. But if you only have one instance of the word book, how are you going to know what a book is? And the only way to know, and the only way those dictionaries know, is by the commentaries of the Acharyas. In other words, it's a received tradition, and this is why Prabhupada says you must receive this knowledge through parampara. It's, of course, important to get the right siddhanta, but there's also a very practical purpose for it. If you ignore parampara, you're just not going to understand half of what's there, because those words may be completely new, or it must be words that are not used anywhere else in that manner, in a different context, because the typical meaning of the word book won't apply in this situation. It actually won't make any sense. So you have to use some other kind of secondary meaning. Oh, the policeman booked me, right? Oh, okay. Different meaning of the word book, right? To cite someone or something. How are you going to know? By commentary. Okay? So the vocabulary is so tough, and the grammar as well. Bhagavatam uses language and grammar a Vedic Sanskrit, even though it's one of the Puranas. So Vedic Sanskrit and classical Sanskrit are very different. Vedic Sanskrit, the ability to recite and understand it is practically lost, that expertise. And this is one of the reasons why we're not encouraged to do Vedic sacrifices. It's a very difficult thing to do, all kinds of pitfalls. But Bhagavatam uses Vedic language, Vedic Sanskrit. Just like this first verse, Satyam Param Dhimahi. The word Dhimahi is a Vedic form. This is why you find it in the Gayatri Mantra. The classical Sanskrit form should be Dhyayema, right? But Bhagavatam uses the Vedic form, Dhimahi. So you have to know Vedic Sanskrit in order to understand it. And it's still quite difficult because of the vocabulary. It's often said amongst Sanskritists, traditional Sanskritists in India, that your Sanskrit learning is tested. It comes to a test by the Bhagavatam. Right? So you may consider yourself a Sanskrit Pandit, but we'll really see when you can actually understand what the Bhagavatam is saying. That's the test. One, Sanskrit learning is tested by Srimad Bhagavatam. When I was studying at Oxford, I had a professor. He visited several times there from the University of Madras in India. Narasimhachari was his name. And wonderful Sri Vaishnava, very strict in his practices and initiated member of the Sampradaya and so on. And incredibly learned person. He had, his abilities, his titles he had received. He was called Ashu Kavishekara, he's called, which means he who is expert at creating Sanskrit poetry on the spot, immediately. So he could compose a verse just like that. I once made some photocopies for him to help him out for his class. And when I gave it to him, he thanked me by creating a Sanskrit verse, saying thank you, And so if you ever used to wonder, is it really possible that the Gita could have been spoken like a conversation? It's after all, it's poetry and everything matches and exactly 8 syllables per line. And can people talk like that? We don't talk in poetry, we just talk in regular language. And the answer is yes. Right? To this day, you can find people who are capable of doing that. Very few remaining, but still it's possible. And you can imagine 5,000 years ago how good they were. He received this title called, Ashtavadhani. Someone who can do 8 things at once. And I just explained to you briefly how it works because it's absolutely stunning. The person who's competing for this title sits in the middle and 8 Sanskrit pundits sit around him. And the first pundit will say, tell me a verse write a verse about Lord Damodara, okay, for example. Or about Lord Ramachandra, say, okay. But give me only the first line of the verse. So you choose the meter and you choose the full verse, but give me only the first line. And then after you give him the first line, he says, okay, that's enough. Then you go to the next person and he says, you write me a verse. Give me a verse on this story, okay? But give me only one syllable at a time. And when you say the first syllable, he'll try to guess what the second syllable is and forbid that, disallow. So say you're saying on Lord Ramachandra. So your first syllable is Ra. Right? So he says, you're going to do Ma because it's Rama, verse is about Ra. So he says Ma Nishiddha. Ma is forbidden. You can't use it. So the whole line which you had set up, because in Sanskrit you have to think in the whole line right at the start, because everything has to fit according to the meter, right? Number of syllables, long and short, all has to fit. You can't have an extra syllable hanging at the end. It's just not allowed. So Ma Nishiddha. So you have to rethink the whole verse. Ra, Ja. Okay, Ra, Ja. Whew, got out of that one. Then he thinks, what are you going to do next? Now maybe you're going to do Rama, right? Ra, Ja, Rama. So Ra Nishiddha. Okay? And then like this. So you complete one line, and he says, okay, fine. Then the third guy goes. And he says, I want you to read the story of Nala and Damayanti from the Akasha Purana. The Akasha Purana is the Purana in the sky, which means you have to compose it, but fast enough where it looks like you're reading. Okay? So, Asi, Draja, Nalo, Nama, Virasa. There was once a king, his name was Nala, he was very strong. And you have to keep reciting. At some point he says, okay, had enough. next guy, and he'll talk to you about some local politics in Sanskrit, how are things going and this and that and so on. And like this, each person will do. And when you come back to the first person, he won't remind you of anything. He'll say, give me the second line of the verse. The third person will say, now give me the next syllable, right? And you have to remember which letters were forbidden. And then the third person will pick up the conversation exactly where he left off. You have to continue the Akasha Purana reading exactly where you left off. And all this time, there's the eighth person sitting behind you throwing flowers at your neck. And you have to count how many times the flowers hit you continuously. Someone who can do all of this, it takes like 4, 5, 6 hours. This is called Ashtavadhani, someone who can do 8 things at once. He received this title when he was like 16 years old or something, 16, 17 years old. So we're talking about someone who's very learned, you know. And he used to say, oh, this is nothing. You never met my guru, right? You should see what he was like. I would come to study with him, and he would say, what work do you want to study today? Oh, I want to study Ramanujacharya's commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Okay, you have a copy? Yes. Okay, so he'd pick it up, and then he'd say, how's your family doing? How are things going? And in the meantime, he's flipping through the book. And then once he's done flipping, he hands it back to him, and then he starts reading from page number 1, right? While the student is following in the book. In other words, he has the whole literature memorized. And this is how good it was. He'd never used any books. It was all here. So one day, he was, Narasimhacharya, the relevant point is he came to Oxford and he was giving a seminar on Srimad Bhagavatam, specifically the 10th canto. And after the first couple of weeks, he came to me and he said, you know, I'm not being arrogant when I say that I've read everything there is to read in terms of Sanskrit literature. And I know it pretty well. He said, it's just a fact. I mean, it's not being arrogant. It's just true. And when in his case, you know it's true. Okay? But he said, I've never, ever read anything as beautiful as Bhagavatam. He said, I'm reading this first time seriously. He had read it before, kind of generally. But first time going into it, because he was teaching it, he said, and there's nothing that compares to it. And he was so moved by the Bhagavatam. And we may say that, of course, but coming from his mouth, it really means a lot. Because this is someone who, you know, who's read it all, who knows it all by heart, who's read the best that's out there, from Kalidasa to Ramayana to anything. And he's just, there's just no comparison to Bhagavatam. So in terms of its poetry, in terms of its philosophy, in terms of its language, in terms of the grammar, Bhagavatam is just, it's out of the ordinary. It's extraordinary in every way. What the thing to remember for us is to think about, really, is just what a contribution Srila Prabhupada gave us, what he accomplished in the course of his lifetime. That this type of work, which is considered the most difficult for all of Sanskritists to work on, he translated in his spare time. And as he was traveling around the world, managing a family of devotees, every morning he'd be awake, every morning. And this is one thing he would do without fail, is sit and translate Srimad Bhagavatam. Not an easy task, not child's play. Right? For a Sanskritist, Gita, Mahabharata, Ramayana, this is easy, relatively speaking. Sanskrit, Bhagavatam is tough, it's difficult. If you've even tried memorizing verses, you know how much more difficult it is to memorize Bhagavatam verses than it is Gita's verses. And every day he would do this without fail. This is an act of great scholarship. Sometimes people say, you know, this and that, Prabhupada didn't give us everything, and Prabhupada is, you know, just read his Srimad Bhagavatam. And not only did he translate it, okay, that's one thing, but then he wrote commentary on it that allows the Bhagavatam, that makes it accessible and understandable to our kind, to our type today. If you read Jiva Goswami Sandarbhas, he's explaining the Bhagavatam. And yet his explanation of the Bhagavatam is completely ununderstandable to us. It's inexplicable. It takes a lot of work to just understand a few things he's saying. It's really tough material. And yet, I had this experience several times, you know, reading Jiva Goswami's commentary on some verse of Bhagavatam. And I said, wow, this is amazing. This is, whoa. You know, after you spend the whole day figuring it out, this is just mind-blowing. He said, I wonder what Prabhupada says on this. And you go back, and it's all there. It's all there. And yet, when I read it there, I thought, oh, okay, yeah. It's easy to understand. And so I didn't value it. Right? Somehow, because it was so easy, so accessible. Oh, I've heard this before. You know, he's talking about the soul and the Paramatma and Bhagavan. And I know. And I missed half of what was there. I missed it. Because my mind cheated me and said, ah, this is easy. You've heard it before 100 times. Don't worry. You know this philosophy. Prabhupada not only worked on the most difficult thing, translated it, but then he made it accessible to those who are non-specialists, people like us, and applied it to our own time, our own world. So all those examples that the Acharyas give in their commentary, Prabhupada gives those examples, but in the modern context. The Acharyas will be arguing against the Mimamsakas or the Charvakas. And in order to understand them, you'd have to go back and study the Mimamsa Shastra and the Charvaka's view and this. Oh, that's what they're arguing against. Prabhupada, he'll give the same arguments, but he'll talk about atheistic scientists. Right? And put it in language showing that those arguments are not gone, they're not dead, they're just reincarnated in a different way, in a different language. And he'll speak, he'll make it relevant for our time, for our place, and give us a practical roadmap how to apply Srimad Bhagavatam's teachings. To accomplish all of that, that's unheard of in the history of the world. Right? It's unheard of. Most or all commentaries were written about Bhagavatam Sanskrit in Sanskrit. That's a much easier thing to do. To convey the Bhagavatam's message in a language that was never made to convey that message, it's difficult. Right? It's not easy. It's very difficult, actually. So, you know, as devotees, we have to be very mindful and very grateful of what we've received through Srila Prabhupada. Because all of this that we're talking about, the greatness of the Bhagavatam and the glories of the Bhagavatam and so on, we have it at our fingertips, thanks to his mercy. We have it at our fingertips. And we're very fortunate for that fact. That level of accessibility, Bhagavatam is more accessible than the Vedas, right? But nowhere has it, no time in history has it become more accessible than it is today, where practically anyone can read it in any language, regardless of their level, regardless of their education, their abilities, whatever, but it's there, right there. Okay. So, Jiva Goswami establishes this point, that Bhagavatam is the highest of all the scriptures. I think we've worked through this quite thoroughly and systematically. Then his task is to show that the Bhagavatam is teaching Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, right? Because if he can show that, then he can show that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is the topmost, because the Bhagavatam is the topmost source of knowledge. So how do you show that the Bhagavatam contains or preaches or teaches Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy? How do you equate the two? And this is not easy, because the Bhagavatam itself is vast, 18,000 verses. A huge work. And you can prove a lot of different things from the Bhagavatam if you don't know how to read it properly. All different kinds of ideas and concepts and things are there. If you go to the churning of the milk ocean, for example. Such beautiful prayers in praise of Lord Shiva, where he's called all those things that we normally reserve just for Lord Krishna. And what's worse, well, not bad, but what makes it more difficult is that even Lord Vishnu standing there saying these prayers to Lord Shiva. And you can quote that and say, therefore, Swayam Bhagavan is Lord Shiva. So there's so many things you can prove in a text that's that broad, right? You can take something and say, oh, this is what it says, what it means. So figuring out what the Bhagavatam is actually saying is not easy. And then at the same time, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is so vast and so many different aspects of it, so many different sides to it, that summarizing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy or understanding what it's saying is not easy either. So Jiva Goswami, he has a very nice strategy. And what he does is he says, okay, these two things we have to equate. We have to show how they're the same. So in order to do that, let me condense both. Okay, let me find the essence of both. Present both in a nutshell. The nutshell, the essence of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, and the essence or the nutshell of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then if I can show that those two things match, then I can show that the primary purpose or intent of both Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy and Srimad Bhagavatam are the same, right? So you take some things that are big, condense them into their essence, into their nutshell, then equate them, show that they're the same, and then you've made your point. This is his strategy, okay? Very good and very straightforward strategy. So let me ask you this question. If you had to condense or summarize all of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy in just a single concept, what would it be? Now, if you've attended one of my seminars on Jiva Goswami before, you're not allowed to answer because you ruined the fun for everyone else. Okay. So if you've attended one of these seminars, you recall, then no speaking. Because you may have heard it in Washington, D.C. or something. This is for the locals. Okay, so if you had to summarize Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy in one idea or one concept, what would it be? Okay, Sankirtan movement. Now, let me clarify. We're looking strictly for philosophy here, so the more philosophical aspects, not so much in terms of practice or bhakti or the kind of the devotional side. Okay, we're looking kind of hardcore philosophy, that type of thing. Okay, so there's no disagreement with what you're saying, but we're looking for something in that direction, because Jiva Goswami is interested in philosophy right now. Yes, Mate. Okay, Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. Excellent. Except that doesn't count for now as a single concept because it's the name for the entire system. You see what I mean? Achintya Bheda Bheda is the name for our entire philosophical system. So what I'm looking for is a single concept. That's the heart of the tradition, of the philosophical. Something that really is the key, the pillar to our whole philosophy. Without it, we'd be lost. Yes. But we're not working on practice so much. Our behavior, devotion, that philosophy, okay? Concepts, ideas. Not yourself, sorry. Anyone else? Some more ideas. What are important pillars in our philosophy? Yes. Prema, okay. But don't go on the devotion side, not the practice side. Philosophy side. You're not this body. That kind of thing, okay? More ideas. Yes, Mataji. Yeah. Great. Vadanti tat tattva vidas. What about that verse is the essential concept that you're pinpointing? Okay, excellent, very good. So there's three aspects of the absolute truth. But if we had to choose one of them, what would it be? Of the three aspects? Bhagavan, right? And Jiva Goswami says, yes. Bhagavan, that is, God is ultimately a supreme person. Personal God. That is the philosophical cornerstone of our philosophy, right? Because if you lose that, then bhakti, prema, sankirtan is all gone. Right? It's all out the window. And if you get someone to agree that God is a person, then they have no choice but to serve him. Right? You've already won 90% of the battle. Because if God is a person, and he's God, i.e. the Supreme Person, then how, what are you going to do about him? Right? What are you going to do about him? You're not going to ignore him. You can't. Not a good idea, at least. So the point is, in terms of philosophically, the idea that Bhagavan, and by Bhagavan, Jiva Goswami, he's using this as a technical term, not just as Bhagavan meaning just general God, but Bhagavan is a very technical term, which he defines very carefully. And for that definition, where is it? There should be a box of photocopies around here. Is it somewhere hiding there on the side? Yeah, there it is, Staples box. So if I could get some help for handing these out, to do it quickly, let's split the stack. If you can give half to the Matajis here, and then so. And I can give me one too. Before we read any of this, let me ask you another question. What is the most important characteristic of Bhagavan, of this concept of the personal Godhead, according to our philosophy? What is the thing, that attribute of his, that is most crucial to the concept of Bhagavan? Inconceivable, what? Someone else? Relations, good, what else? Renunciation? Ananda? There's all of these are correct, but there's one concept that combines it all together, that brings all of these things together, and that's the idea of Shakti, that the Lord possesses Shakti or energies. You see, Krishna's whole spiritual world and his transcendental form and his beauty and his relationships and his Ananda, what is that? What is that? His energy, right? Which energy? His internal energy, antaranga shakti. If we want to talk about God as the creator of this world, and he creates everything, that's true, right? But that's also his energy, right? His external energy. If you want to talk about us and our relationship with the Lord, then we're his marja energy, tatastha shakti. So the idea of shakti is kind of central. It kind of combines all of the... Bhagavan is the central pillar of our philosophy, and Bhagavan's most important quality is that he is Shaktiman. He's Superman. He's the possessor of all Shaktis. So turn to page 3 in your handout, the third page. So Jiva Goswami gives a definition of Bhagavan. In this in this section. This is section 100 from Bhagavad Sandarbha, the second Sandarbha. And I'm just going to read the Sanskrit for you, just so you get a little flavor for how Jiva Goswami writes. This has, anywhere you see a dash, it's not a new word, right? It's the same word. The dash is just there to help us read. Jiva Goswami, Sanskrit has some of the longest words in any language of the world. And Jiva Goswami loves using long words. So, notice how long they get. Tadevam sachidanandaika rupa swarupa bhuta chintya vichitrananda shakti yukto dharmatva eva dharmitvam nirbhedatva eva nana bhedavatvam arupitva eva rupitvam vyapakatva eva madhyamatvam satyameve tyadi paraspara viruddhananta guna nidhi sthula sukshma vilakshana swa prakasha akhanda swa swarupa bhuta shi vigraha. Okay, that was a long word. तथा भूत भगवद आख्य मुख्यैक विग्रह व्यंजित तद तादृशानंत विग्रहस तादृश स्वानुरूप शक्त्याविर्भाव लक्षण लक्ष्मी रंजित वामांश स्वप्रभा विशेषाकार परिच्छद परिकर निज धामसु विराजमानाकार स्वरूप शक्ति विलास लक्षण अद्भुत गुण लीलादि चमत्कारितात्मा रामादि गणो निज सामान्य प्रकाशाकार ब्रह्म तत्वो निजाशयैक जीवन जीवाख्य तटस्थ शक्तिर अनंत प्रपंच व्यंजित स्वाभास शक्ति गुणो भगवान इति. The last two words we can understand. This is Bhagavan. Okay? So, English. He who is the very form of existence, consciousness, and bliss, who possesses inconceivable, multifarious, and unlimited energies. So there we go, Shakti. That are of his own nature, who is the ocean of unlimited, mutually contradictory qualities. This is one of Jiva Goswami's favorite descriptions of Bhagavan. He who is the ocean of unlimited contradictory qualities. Such that in him, both the attribute and the possessor of attributes, the lack of differences and varieties of differences, formlessness and form, pervasiveness and centrality, means being in one place, all are true. Whose beautiful form is distinct from both gross and subtle entities, self-luminous and consisting entirely of his own nature. So his form is not Maya like our form is. I mean, it's not made of Prakriti. Who has unlimited such forms that are manifested by his chief form called Bhagavan, whose left side is beautified by Lakshmi, the manifestation of his personal energy. So we have Antaranga Shakti there. Whose left side, suitable to his own form, who resides in his own abode along with his associates, who are furnished with a form that is a special manifestation of his own splendor, who astonishes the hosts of Atma Ramas, those who take pleasure in the self, by his wonderful qualities, pastimes, etc., which are characterized by the play of his personal energy, whose own generic brilliance is manifested in the form of the reality of Brahman, so Brahma Jyoti, who is the sole shelter and life of his marginal energy, that's us, called the living entities, jivas, and whose mere reflected energy are the modes of nature, gunas, visible in the unlimited phenomenal world. He is Bhagavan. Anyway. So all of Bhagavad Sandarbha is basically dedicated to just proving this one statement. Okay, this is kind of the summary statement of that entire second Sandarbha, Bhagavad Sandarbha. And once this is done, then the job is done. Okay, so the word Bhagavan is a very technical term. And his goal is to show that the Bhagavatam is all about Bhagavan. Now, you could say, well, that's easy, right? The word Bhagavata itself means that which is related to Bhagavan. So that's not going to be difficult. But he's not using Bhagavan in just a technical sense. I mean, just a straightforward sense. He means Bhagavan, he means this, okay? This is what he means by it. So, how can we find Bhagavan? How can we prove that the Bhagavata's main point is Bhagavan? That is, a personal Godhead possessing these energies. If you can show this is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, basically. Okay? Beyond all this, then it's just, okay, how do we practice this? It's abhideya. What do we do about this? Right? And what's the goal? But once you've got this in mind, like I said, you've won the battle already. So, how to show that Bhagavatam teaches this concept of Bhagavan? Well, we have to do the same thing on this side. We summarize Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy in a nutshell. Now we have to summarize the entire Bhagavatam in a nutshell, because we're not going to go through all 18,000 verses. You could. That would be a life-changing experience. But in the interest of time, Jiva Goswami wants to write a book that is actually readable for most people. So he's saying, okay, how can we condense what the Bhagavatam is saying? So let me ask you now a second question. If you were to look for places in the Bhagavatam that were essential verses or sections or that encapsulize the entire work, what would they be? Okay? What would they be? Now, your choice has to be defendable, not just based on our philosophy. We think this is the ultimate truth, so I'm going to choose that verse. No. Based on the Bhagavatam's own internal logic. In other words, you should be able to argue for your choice. That this is an essential section, okay, of the Bhagavatam. That this section contains the meaning of the entire work. What are those essential verses or passages that come to mind? What would you choose? Anyone?
First one.
Okay. Why?
That contain the whole thing, creation, suspense, and destruction. Krishna itself is self-sufficient. He doesn't need anybody.
Yeah. But that's based on our philosophy. Right? Why? How would you argue to someone who doesn't accept our philosophy? Why is that verse important in Bhagavatam? It's a simple reason.
Just the fact that it's the first one,
right? So in the introduction, you're likely to have a good sense of what the book is about as a whole. Most people do this in their introductions, just like we read Prabhupada's preface. Right? This is what I'm writing about in Bhagavatam. So it's a good choice. What else? Okay, the last verse. Right? What is does he end with? The conclusion of the text. Very good. What else? What is that verse? Okay, ete chansa kalapunsa. That's there, although it's a little bit more difficult to justify in terms of its location. In terms of the structure of the text itself, the beginning and the end, but what other sections are important? Ete chansa is important, actually. Jiva Goswami does a lot with that verse. What else? We know this. Huh? Yes. That's if you're already looking for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I mean, it's important because it comes at the end and it tells us what happens in Kali Yuga. It's okay. It's also important. Jiva Goswami does a long lot with that verse. These are all good choices. Ete chansa, like that. How about Chaturshloki Bhagavatam? Okay, the four essential verses. Very crucial and defensible, not just based on Chaturshloki. Well, a lot of acharyas identify those as the chief verses. But they're also the four verses that are spoken at the very beginning of creation. So this is the source of knowledge, right? Right at the start. So if you can show that the very first words that came out of God's mouth when he spoke to the very first person in this creation, and which was the source of the Bhagavatam, if you can show what they mean, then you know what everything else means, right? Because everything, they're like the seed. If you can show that the seed is a banyan seed, then you know the tree is going to come out, is going to be a banyan tree. Right? So the four essential verses. How about also Vyasadeva Samadhi? The verses which describe what Vyasadeva saw within his Samadhi. Why would that be important? Based on what we've already discussed, you know the answer to this. No, not based on content, but in terms of the structure of the Bhagavatam. Why would that be important? What Vyasadeva saw in his Samadhi to establish the meaning of Bhagavatam. It's the mature conclusion. Means Vyasadeva was told to write about this, to write about Krishna's pastimes, right? So what did he do then after he was instructed in this way? He entered into meditation. He went into Samadhi. And then he saw everything within Samadhi. And then whatever he saw, he recorded. What he saw, he wrote down. So if you can show that what he saw is Bhagavan, then you've shown that the entire Bhagavatam's meaning is Bhagavan, right? You see what Jiva Goswami is doing? You take sections that are the Bhagavatam itself regards as summaries of the work. Chaturshloki, Vyasadeva Samadhi, this last verse at the end of the list of whole avatars. Now that it's all done, ete chang shakalapunsa, right? The first verse, the last verse, and you say, these verses, if I can show that the actual teaching is Bhagavatam, then I've made my point. Right? I've made my point. So let's take a look at one example. Okay, this is Vyasadeva Samadhi. This is the second to last page. Just the next one from your definition of Bhagavan. Vyasadeva Samadhi. And we can recite these. You can repeat after me. They're very nice verses. This is the entire Bhagavatam right here, okay? Full Bhagavatam. Because it describes Vyasadeva Samadhi, and then he wrote this into the Bhagavatam. He expanded it out into 18,000 verses. Tasmin sva ashrame vyaso badari shanda mandite asinopa upasprishya pranidadhyo manasvayam. In that place, Srila Vyasadeva, in his own ashram, was surrounded by berry trees, sat down to meditate after touching water for purification. Okay, so this is an introductory verse. Now comes his samadhi. Bhakti yogena manasi. Samyak pranihite male. Apashyat purusham purnam. Mayam chatadapashrayam. Thus he fixed his mind, perfectly engaging it by linking it in devotional service, bhakti yoga, without any tinge of materialism. And thus he saw the absolute personality of Godhead along with his external energy, which was under his full control. Yaya sammohito jiva. Atmanam trigunatmakam. Paropi manute nartham. Tatkritam chabhipadyate. Due to this external energy, the living entity, although transcendental to the three modes of material nature, thinks of himself as a material product and thus undergoes the reactions of material miseries. Anartho pashamam sakshat. Bhakti yogam madhokshaje. Lokasya janato vidvangsh. Chakre sattvata sanghitam. The material miseries of the living entity, which are superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. Now, we need to show that the content of Vyasadeva Samadhi was Bhagavan. Right? And Bhagavan in the specific way that we've defined him. So, first of all, where do you find Bhagavan in these verses? Can anyone point to the specific words in the verse or in the translation? Okay, raise your hand. Yes. Purusham Purnam. There you go. Purusham Purnam. The complete person. The whole person is there. Purusham Purnam. Okay. What's the most important attribute of Bhagavan?
Energy.
Energies. Where's energy? Where are the Shaktis here? Okay, so the external energy is right there. Mayam chetadabhashrayam. Maya, which is completely under his control. And the marginal energy, us. Yes. Where is that? Yaya sammohito jiva. Okay. So, it's connecting the two. The Lord's energy, which is sammohito, yayasa, by which the jiva is completely bewildered, completely confused. So you have Bhagavan, you have his energies, you have the problem, the statement of the problem. What's the problem that the Bhagavatam is trying to solve? Yaya sammohito jiva. Right? Anartho pashamam sakshat. Trying to get rid of all that is unnecessary and dirty and unwanted within our heart by which we are bewildered. Trying to get rid of that. That's the problem. And what's the solution? Bhakti yogam adhokshaje. Devotional service to Lord Krishna. There you have it. Right? The whole thing encapsulated. Perfectly in accord with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojana. All there. There's only one thing missing. What is that? Quite an important thing, actually. No, Bhakti Yoga Madhokshaje. Yeah, his internal potency. Right? Where's the internal energy? He mentions external, he mentions us. And Jiva Goswami explains this. He says, the internal energy is so closely related to the Lord that it does not require separate specification. In fact, it's present embedded in the word Purnam, Purusham Purnam. Because he says it's like if you have the full moon, right? Purna Chandra, suppose you're talking about. The full moon has risen in the sky. Then you don't have to separately say, oh, I saw the full moon, and you know, I also saw the moon rays, or the light of the moon. It's obvious, right? If you say, the moon has risen, I've seen the moon, then the rays of the moon, they have to be there, because there's no moon without its light. The internal rays of the moon, the brightness, that's the very nature of the moon. So when it says Purusham Purnam, the full personality of God, it is there. His internal energy is embedded. You cannot. What you don't know is external and marginal energies. And so those are specified specifically. So he's there. Then the Chaturshloki. I don't have a handout for that. But the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam. What's the first verse of the Chaturshloki? What does Krishna say in that first verse? The first verse, you remember? Famous. This is Chaturshloki Gita, you're mentioning. That's good. But Chaturshloki Bhagavatam. It also, in fact, it begins with the same word. Aham Sarvasya Prabhu, same word begins Chaturshloki Bhagavatam. Evagre, exactly. Aham evasam evagre. And that means, in the beginning, only I was there. It was just me. Aham evasam evagre. It's actually very interesting that Chaturshloki Gita and Chaturshloki Bhagavatam begin with the same word. It just goes to show that the real point of everything is aham. Right? And aham, of course, not me, but Krishna. Right? When Krishna says, aham, I'm the point. Oh, okay. That's the point. So, aham evasam evagre. Only I was there in the beginning. Nothing else existed. And the question we have in those Chaturshloki is, where is Bhagavan? Where is Bhagavan in the Chaturshloki? In order to find Bhagavan is actually not very difficult. All you have to do is look at the context of the verse. The very first word is aham. And who's the aham speaking? What's the context of the verse? What has just happened before Krishna speaks this Chaturshloki Bhagavatam? Anyone know? Yes. Brahma has just been born. And then? What happens? Brahma is born. He's all confused. He goes up and down the lotus stem. He can't figure out where he's at, where he's from. Then, meditation. He hears the words and he meditates. And after 100 celestial years of meditation, then someone turns the lights on. And he goes, wow. And he sees everything around him. And most importantly, he sees Lord Vishnu. He sees the Lord there. And the Lord is present. There's a beautiful description of him. He's there with, it describes Bhagavatam. All his energies are present there. All the 16 different energies of the Lord are present. And he's dressed in beautiful yellow clothing and a dark bluish complexion with a peacock feather and a crown upon his head and four hands and holding different items in his arms. And it's a full description of Bhagavan, of the Lord, with all his energies. And just in case you have any doubt who was speaking this Bhagavatam, this Chaturshloki, and who is referred to by aham, it's me who's the point. Just in case you still have any doubt, what does Vishnu do once he shows himself to Brahma? Do you remember? It's quite nice. Yeah. He walks up and he shakes his hand. And he says, Bhadram te. He says, good luck to you. Right? From one creator to another, good luck to you. It's a tough job. And he comes and he shakes his hand. Now, this is very significant. We can speculate, say, oh, maybe it's not Krishna, maybe it's some image of Krishna that I'm projecting, or maybe it's the self behind Krishna that's actually the one who's speaking. Maybe it's the Brahman who's living within Krishna. There's so many different theories people have. This aham could refer to anything. Maybe it refers to me. But when someone walks up to you and shakes your hand, Right? That is the most direct and clear and obvious way to establish your presence. No more guessing and this and that. You know, he could be. Madan Gopal Prabhu could be a hallucination, apparition, maybe a projection. Right? But if I go up and I shake his hand, then I know, okay, he's there. Right? This is very practical reality. Krishna walks up and he shakes his hand. And then he says, Ahameva Samevagre. Only I was existing at the beginning. And Jiva Goswami says, only I was existing at the beginning? It means I, with all my energies and all my associates and my transcendental abode and all my leelas, was existing at the beginning. And you go, oh, hold on here. This is going too far. Krishna just said only he exists. And you're saying him with everything else? His pastime, his abode, etc. Where do they all come from? And Jiva Goswami says, yes. He says, this is a fact. When I say, for example, I lived in Oxford. Right? I existed in Oxford. What comes to mind? When I was somewhere, then it doesn't mean that I was existing in some sort of ethereal, solipsistic space where no one else was there, you know, kind of hanging on my own and nothing else existed in some big vacuum. No, I was there means I, with my home and my clothes and my friends and my job and whatever else I was doing, right? This is the meaning of I. He also gives the example of when you say, there goes the king. Right? Suppose the procession, we take a modern example. Right? You see the motorcade going by and someone says, hey, that's president. That's Obama. Right? There goes Obama. Now, if you say something like that, I don't expect to see Obama kind of having a stroll down the street. Right? This is not how presidents move around. What does it mean? Motorcade, all his associates, at least even if he's out for a private jog, there'll be secret service everywhere. Right? He's got his Shakti's energies present before him. Right? So when Krishna says, I existed at the beginning, it's a simple statement. He's pointing to himself and he's saying, I, as you see me now, I'm standing here right in front of me, no need to speculate, right? I was there in the beginning. Bas. This world wasn't there. This creation wasn't there. You weren't there. I was there. And look at me. Look at my world. He gives him the full darshan. Chintamani prakara sadmasukalpa vriksha. All of this was there. So Bhagavan, aham, that Bhagavan, is the main meaning of the Chatushloki Bhagavatam. And like this, he goes through so many different important sections of Bhagavatam. Vadanti tat tatva vidas, that verse, ete chang sakalapunsa, that verse, even Krishna varnam tusha Krishnam, not in the Sandarbhas, but in his commentary on the Sandarbhas, sarva samvadini, he has a detailed explanation of that verse. Because it gives a prescription for this age, and so it's significant what we should be doing now. And he shows, obviously, that one is quite straightforward. Right? Bhagavan is there, Krishna varnam. Now, last thing. He uses one very wonderful technique to establish the meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam. To show what we're supposed, the message that the Bhagavatam is ultimately conveying is Bhagavan. And that technique is actually a very ancient one. It comes all the way from the Mimamsakas who... You know, they flourished thousands of years ago during Vedic times when Vedic rituals were being performed, yajñas. And they use this in order to understand the meaning of the Vedas. You can use this technique actually on any book, any work. And basically, it's called Shad Tatparya Linga. Six different aspects of any book that you look at in order to understand what its main point is. If you find a book for the first time you've never read and you want to figure out what its main meaning is, what its point is, and you want to make an argument, and this is the author's main point, then what are the different aspects of the book that you look at? Now, a couple were already mentioned. The introduction. We did that with Bhagavatam. Look at the first part. Because the author usually says, this is what I want to accomplish in the introduction. You look at the end, because the author usually comes around and sets his conclusion forward. What other areas would you look at? The title, the contents, except most Sanskrit manuscripts don't have contents pages. So it's a good place to look, but it probably wouldn't be applicable for contents is a rather new phenomenon. Yeah, so the Mangalacharan or the introduction, the beginning section, good. What else? Look at the list here in your handout. Okay, there's six things he gives. This is the first page. First page. Page number one. Yeah, first page. Yeah. Okay. So the six things are listed here. Number one, the opening verse. Number two, the concluding verse. We already got these. Then number, okay, it's actually both of those are number one. Opening and concluding are counted as one item, 1A and 1B. Then number two is repetition. Look at what the author keeps repeating in the book. This is true of any teacher. If the teacher says something six times, then students know, okay, this is important, probably should take a note. So what the author keeps repeating, that's important. Novelty, okay? What's new or unique? If you read the preface to a book, the author will almost always tell you what this book gives you that other books didn't. Right? There's already, 300 different algebra textbooks. So what's the need for another algebra book? Well, this is the first algebra book that teaches algebra through using cartoons. Never before has this been done. So this is why I'm going to do it. So the author will state, okay, here's the main point of why I'm going to do it. Prabhupada does this at the beginning of his Gita. He says there's over 700 editions of the Gita. But we need one more. Why? Because there's none that are as it is. Then number four, phala. What's the fruit? What does the author state as his aims and objectives? Again, this is something you'll find at different points in the book. The authors say, at the end of studying this textbook, you will be able to, 1, 2, 3. These are my aims and objectives. You should be able to solve these equations. You should be able to do this problem. You should be like that. Then, statements of praise. What are the things that the author himself gets excited about and keeps praising? Wow, this is most amazing. And the most exciting thing is this. And then this is important to establishing the meaning. And then the last one is reasoning or argument. What is the author's thread or thesis or line of argumentation? And can we decipher that? So Jiva Goswami chooses six verses from the Bhagavatam that present these six things and shows that each one of these items is talking about Bhagavan. In other words, the introduction is concerned with Bhagavan, the conclusion is concerned with Bhagavan. What is repeated over and over again in the Bhagavatam? Bhagavan. What is it new? What's new that the Bhagavatam is presenting? Complete focus on Bhagavan, right? Dharma prajita kaitava Bhagavan. What is the Bhagavatam praising over and over again? Bhagavan. What's going to be the fruit of studying Bhagavatam? Bhagavan. Right? And all the argument and reasoning that we present here, where is it going to lead us? Bhagavan. Right? That's his goal. So let's look at these verses. They're very, very nice verses, beautifully selected. And you can literally choose any six verses you want. That's what verses you choose is not important. But those six verses have to match. Like, it's the coherence that's important. So if you want to choose a different verse, that's fine. But then you should be able to find at least five other verses in all of these different categories That's right. Suppose I say that, in fact, what's new about the Bhagavatam is Vritrasura. Right? He's the main point of Bhagavatam. Okay, maybe I have an argument there. Right? The way Vritrasura's story is presented is unique to Bhagavatam. But then I need to be able to find five other verses with all the five other characteristics, all pointing to Vritrasura. So I should be able to show that the Bhagavatam over and over again repeats Vritrasura. Now that's going to be difficult because he shows up in a few chapters, but then Vritrasura is gone. So how are you going to show that Vritrasura is being repeated over and over again? Or novelty, or praise, that the Bhagavatam is mainly praising Vritrasura. So you see the point? You can choose any six verses you want, but whatever it is, they all have to match. They have to coincide, and that's the evidence. That's what works, is the coherence part. So, the first verse. Let's recite these verses together, all together, okay? Janmadhyasya yatonvayaditaratas charteshvabhignya swarat tene brahma hridaya adikavaye muhyanti yatsuraya Tejo vari mridam yatha virimayo yatra trisargo mrisha dhamna svena sada nirasta kuhakam satyam param dhimahi. I'll just read the translation on my own. You can actually read with me. There's nothing wrong with that. O my Lord, Sri Krishna, son of Vasudev, O all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon Lord Sri Krishna because he is the absolute truth and the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, sustenance and destruction. Manifested universe, sorry. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representations of water seen in fire or land seen on water. Only because of him do the material universes, temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature, appear factual, although they are unreal. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendent abode, which is forever free from the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. Remember I said this is one of the most complicated verses in Bhagavatam. Right? Every line of this is, we could talk so much about. And its connection to the Vedanta Sutra, I won't get into. We don't have time for that. And it's quite technical also. But just to point out where Bhagavan is located in this verse. He's there. Satyam param dhimahi. Let us meditate on the supreme absolute truth. Now you could say, well, that's not Bhagavan. That could be impersonal Lord as well. But that satyam param, that supreme absolute truth, is specified in this verse. He's described. What is that satyam param that tells us clearly that it is Bhagavan being referred to here? Yeah, but even more directly. Tene Brahma Hrida, right? Which means what? In the beginning, who instructed this knowledge? Adi Kavaye to Brahma. Right? And we've already shown who instructed this knowledge is Bhagavan, right? There's only one person who did that. So the verse is quite specific who this Satyam Param is. Where is this internal energy? Yeah, someone already mentioned this in answer to my first question. Where is the internal energy in this verse? Dhamna Svena. Right? Dhamna Svena. By his own, in the translation, let's see where it is. Yeah, he's eternally existent in the transcendental abode. Okay, the external energy comes right after that. Nirasta kuhakam and tejo vari midam yatha vinimayo. The illusory representations of water seen in fire or land seen on water And also, which is forever free from the illusory representations of the material world. So it's saying that the Lord's internal energy, dhamna swena, nirasta kuhakam, it destroys his material energy. I mean, it removes it away. And where's the marginal energy? Where are we? No, Trisarga is material energy. Yes, partially. Muhyanti yatsure. Even the sages and the demigods are bewildered. But there's something even stronger. It means including us also. Swarat is internal energy again. He's manifesting himself. This is a little bit of a trick question. It's the last word. Dhimahi. Dhimahi means let us meditate. And what the important thing is not the meditate part here for our purposes, but let us meditate. We will meditate, right? And yeah, here it says I. The verb is a plural one. So it's not just I, it's we. It's a plural verb. So all of us, basically. And Jiva Goswami has a really sweet argument on this. He says, the fact that the plural verb is used, dhimahi, let us meditate, proves that impersonalism is not true. Right? That Bhagavatam is saying, even in the highest level, satyam param, when we're talking about the liberated soul, there many of us are there. And we're not all one. Many of us are present. Just like Krishna says in Gita, right? Natvevaham jatunasam natvam kshema janadipa. Right? That we've all been here forever. And Prabhupada says, this proves that we're eternally individuals. We never become one or lose our individuality. So we're there. We're the ones who are supposed to act. Let us meditate. Let me meditate. I'm here in the verse also. So it's a complete picture of Bhagavan. Okay, the others will go faster. This one, the next one, the concluding verse is recited in the same melody as this first one. Kasmai yena vibhasito yamatulo jnana pradipa pura tadrupena cha naradaya munaye krishnaya tadrupena yogindraya tadatmanatha bhagavat rataya karunyatas tachuddham vimalam vishokam amritam satyam param dhimahi. I meditate upon that pure and spotless supreme absolute truth who is free from suffering and death and who in the beginning personally revealed this incomparable torchlight of knowledge to Brahma. Brahma then spoke it to the sage Narada, who narrated it to Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas. Srila Vyasadeva revealed this Bhagavatam to the greatest of sages, Shukadev Goswami, and Shukadev Goswami mercifully spoke it to Maharaj Parikshit. You have to show that each of these verses is referring to the same thing. With this verse, it's beautifully easy. Right? The conclusion, the punchline of this verse is Satyam Param Dhimahi, which is exactly the same thing as the first verse. How do we know it's Bhagavan? Again, the same point is being made. He instructed this in the beginning to Lord Brahma. Okay, so Bhagavan is clearly present. By the way, this is not exactly Bhagavatam's last verse, but that doesn't matter. It has to be part of the conclusion. But again, you have to choose a verse that matches the two, introduction and conclusion. So it doesn't have to be the very last verse. Then, for repetition, what does Bhagavatam repeat over and over again? And what is the Bhagavatam present that's new? Jiva Goswami uses the same verse to serve two purposes. This one, the meter's a little different. Kalimala sanghati kala no khilesho hariritaratra nagiyate hyabhikshnam ihatu punar bhagavana shesha murti paripatito nupadam katha prasangai. Lord Hari, the supreme controller of all beings, annihilates the accumulated sins of the Kali age. Yet other literatures do not constantly glorify him. But that supreme personality of Godhead, appearing in his innumerable personal expansions, is abundantly and constantly described through the various narrations of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, to prove repetition, you can either show verses that are repeating, So like Jiva Goswami could have shown 10 verses that repeat the same thing. Or you can just find a verse that says, this is what I repeat over and over again. Okay, so Jiva Goswami chose that one. It's more straightforward. Okay, and Bhagavatam says here very clearly, what does it repeat over and over again? Bhagavan. Paripatito anupadam. In every step, in every word, in every line, Bhagavatam is saying this. And what is it? The word is there directly. Bhagavan. In case we have any doubt, it says Harihi. Bhagavan Hari. He's repeated over and over and over again. You know how Prabhupada said that if you read even one line from my books, your life will become perfect? Right? Just one line? This is why. Paripatito anupadam katha prasangai. Because Bhagavan is present in every line. So if you know, if you can read it sincerely and know where to look, you'll find Bhagavan. Even if you read just one line, it can change your life. Because Bhagavan can act through that one line. That's what Bhagavatam repeats. And what's new about the Bhagavan? What's new about the Bhagavatam? What's novel? The exclusive focus on Bhagavan. That there are so many literatures, you could say, that talk about Bhagavan. Not just Bhagavatam. There's others also. But none of the other books talk about Bhagavan exclusively, in every line, repeatedly. In other words, the repetition is itself the novelty. What's new about the Bhagavatam is that it's this constant, exclusive, even obsessive focus on the Lord. That's new about Bhagavatam. No other literature does that. Then, what is the fruit of studying Bhagavatam? Pibantiye bhagavata atmana satam kathamritam shavanaputeshu sambhritam punantite vishaya vidushitasayam vrajanti tacharanasaro ruhantikam. Those who drink through oral reception, fully filled with the nectarian message of Lord Krishna, the beloved of the devotees, purify the polluted aim of life known as material enjoyment and thus go back to Godhead, to the lotus feet of Him, the personality of Godhead. So there you have it. There's the fruit. We all go back to Bhagavan. And the very word is used, Pivantiye Bhagavata Atmanasatam. One who hears, who drinks, again, these katha, these pastimes of Bhagavan, they go. Vrajanti tat charana suroru hantikam. They go to His lotus feet. The fruit of Bhagavatam. Then what does the Bhagavatam praise? This is a beautiful, beautiful verse. It's the, we can sing it in the same meter as the previous one. Yam Brahma Varunendra Rudra Maruto Stunvanti Divyai Stavai Vedai Sangha Padakramo Panishadai Gayanti Yam Samaga Dhyana Vastita Tadgatena Manasa Pashyanti Yam Yogino Yasyantam Navidu Sura Suragana Devaya Tasmai Namah. It's actually very good timing. We paid our obeisances Tasmai Namah by reciting this verse. Sudha Goswami said, unto that personality of Godhead, unto that personality, whom Brahma, Varuna, Indra, Rudra, and Maruts praise by chanting transcendental hymns and reciting the Vedas with all their corollaries, Padakramas in Upanishads, to whom the chanters of the Samaveda always sing, whom the perfected yogis see within their minds after fixing themselves in trance and absorbing themselves within Him, and whose limit can never be found by any demigod or demon. Unto that Supreme Personality of Godhead, I offer my humble obeisances. Where is Bhagavan in this verse? Devaya, exactly. I offer obeisances to Him. Now you could say, well, okay, Deva, that doesn't work. Right? That can mean anyone. But not really. We know who this Deva is simply by the process of elimination. Right? The verse mentions everyone else as praising this Deva. Okay? So maybe Brahma is this Deva. Yam Brahma. Right? Or maybe it's Indra. No, Yam Brahma Varunendra Indra. There's okay. Maybe it's Lord Shiva. Ah, Rudra. Okay. Maybe by the Vedas we by the Deva we mean the Vedas. The scriptures are the highest, like the Mimamsakas say. Vedai Sangha Pada Krama Upanishadai. Maybe it's some yogi we know who's really powerful. Right? So all these yogis, Pashyanti Yam Yogino, Dhyana Avastita Tatgatena Manasa. They're meditating on him. So basically the Bhagavatam covers everyone, says, who's left over? That person. Right? We're praising. And that's, of course, Lord Vishnu, Bhagavan. Last one. This is the reasoning verse. This is simple meter like Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavan sarva bhuteshu lakshita swatmana hari drishyair buddhyadi bhir drashta lakshanair anumapakai. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Shri Krishna, is in every living being along with the individual soul. And this fact is perceived and hypothesized in our acts of seeing and taking help from the intelligence. Now, this verse summarizes the entire Bhagavatam's argument. An argument that builds and proves the existence of Bhagavan. Unfortunately, we don't have time in this seminar to go into that in detail, how the Bhagavatam makes this proof. But Jiva Goswami explains it very, very nicely, very clearly. He starts from the existence of matter, dull matter, like this. Okay, just objects. And using those, he proves the existence of the spirit soul. Then, he uses the existence of the spirit soul to prove the existence of the super soul. And then, he uses the existence of the super soul to prove the existence of Bhagavan. He starts from matter and proves the existence of Bhagavan. Using the strategies, the arguments present within this word, this verse, Lakshana and Anumapaka. There's two different methods of choosing it. And he uses the Indian system of logic called Nyaya, Nyaya Shastra, to make these arguments and to prove it there. Beautiful, beautiful argument. Really, really detailed and impressive. If you want a summary study of this argument, read Prabhupada's purport on this verse, and you'll get the basic gist of it. Okay, the details we don't have time to go into. So these six verses, Jiva Goswami proves that they all point towards Bhagavan, and therefore, these six verses are a beautiful encapsulation of what makes Srimad Bhagavatam so special. Okay? What makes it so wonderful is because if somehow or other we come in contact with Srimad Bhagavatam, it's like you can't escape going back to Godhead. Right? It's the Bhagavatam is so powerful that yena kena prakarena, somehow or other, it's going to give us devotional service to the Lord. Right? It's practically, you cannot resist even if you tried. This is why it's regarded as one of the five most potent aspects of devotional service. We talked about last night, deity, devotee, naam, dham, and Bhagavatam. Right? These five things. The reason they're considered the most potent aspects is because even a little contact with even one of these five things is capable of giving you full perfection in devotional service. And Bhagavatam is one of them. And here you see why. Because if you read Bhagavatam, you cannot escape the absolute truth. Right? Our only struggle really is just to get ourselves to read Bhagavatam and to study it seriously. And to approach it in the right mood. And to enjoy it and relish it. That's the main goal. If you can do that, then the result is guaranteed. It's going to happen. It's 100% certain. We got that guarantee from Srila Prabhupada when we read his purport. First 9 cantos, self-reliance. 10 canto, you're a devotee. And we get that guarantee now from the Bhagavatam itself, saying that very same thing. In every line, in every verse, Krishna is inescapable. So, if there's any one thing that we can take away from this seminar, right, is this added determination, right, added reinforced determination to dive deeply into this ocean of Srimad Bhagavatam. This ocean is so deep that there's no doubt we'll drown. Right? No doubt. In fact, Sridhar Swami begins his commentary with this point. He says, where am I? Where is this Bhagavatam, which is like this huge ocean of milk? And where am I, this little amoeba, right, trying to swim? How can I ever get to the other side, make heads or tails? Even understand even a little bit of it? But he says, just like the Lord lifted Mount Mandara when it kept sinking into the ocean of milk and supported it just so it could churn. So in the same way, may the Lord support my intelligence so that I can churn a little bit of the nectar coming from this Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna will help us. He's right there in the pages of Bhagavatam. And of course, the most important thing is that we receive it through parampara. We're so fortunate that we've received this through Srila Prabhupada. We have not only his translation and his commentary, but also hundreds of hours of lectures on Srimad Bhagavatam. Very profound. Read a section from Bhagavatam, hear Prabhupada's lectures on that section. Just on the first verse, you can take months. Very, very valuable resource. Just think, every single one of our acharyas, they spent their life studying this work. Prabhupada, he said, I put everything into my Bhagavatam, and yet you all don't study. You remember he said statements like this? He was heartbroken. He said, I didn't write these works just so they could sit on some shelf, some nice altar. No. So you read it. He put in so much effort and so much hard work into this, as did every single one of our acharyas. And we have it sitting right here, in an easy-to-understand manner. No one has to go to the forest and study Sanskrit for 12 years. It's right here, accessible. So it's just up to us to take advantage of it and change our lives as a result. So at this point, we have about 10 or 12 minutes. If anyone has any questions, comments. Yes, Mataji. It's a good question. So we hear from Bhagavatam that Krishna is the ultimate supreme source. He's Bhagavan himself. Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. But so often do we, so often we find in Bhagavatam that Lord Vishnu is appearing. Why is that? Why not Krishna coming? Krishna, whoever the devotee calls for is who Krishna is the one who appears. So when devotees call for the Lord in a certain aspect of his, as majestic and as powerful and as awe-inspiring and as the granter of all wishes, then the Lord appears in that form. If the devotees call upon him in a particular form, say as Lord Ramachandra, the Lord will appear in that form. So in Bhagavatam, he doesn't just appear as Krishna. He appears in so many different forms, as Lord Vishnu, but also as Lord Ram, as Lord Narsingha, as Lord Vamana, as Lord Matsya, as Lord Kurma. Whatever form the devotees need him in, that form Krishna is ready to appear. But at the same time, the Bhagavata makes it crystal clear that of all of these forms, Krishna is the supreme, he's the highest. And this is in fact not just a matter of our opinion, okay? Even academic studies done by non-devotees have made this point very clear, that what the Bhagavatam is uniquely doing is focusing itself on Krishna specifically. And this is most clearly seen in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam. The 10th canto, Bhagavatam itself, it regards it as the pinnacle of the entire work. It's the crest jewel of all the leelas described, and it's centered upon Lord Krishna. Right, so Krishna is no doubt presented as the Supreme Lord in Srimad Bhagavatam, just as he is in Bhagavad Gita. But that doesn't mean that Krishna doesn't appear in so many other forms, in a variety of different forms. Whenever Krishna has a particular need to perform or a certain devotee to satisfy, he'll come in that form. Lord Krishna actually comes, but he sees him in both manifestations, as Lord Vishnu in his, all his majesty and so on, Bhagavatam describes. But from Brahma Samhita, we understand he also sees Goloka Vrindavan, Krishna as Govinda with the cows and two-handed. But Bhagavatam doesn't discuss that. Bhagavatam discusses his vision of Vaikuntha, of Lord Vishnu specifically. So Lord Brahma sees, he sees the complete spiritual world. Chintamani prakarasadmashu kalpavriksha lakshavriteshu surabhir abhipale. The whole thing is there. Lakshmi sahasra, thousands of Lakshmis are there. He sees the full spectrum. Yeah. It's nice to recite the verses always because they are transcendental sound vibration and they'll benefit us. But there's no need to worry about understanding the meaning of the verses directly. That meaning has been provided to us very clearly and in proper parampara by Srila Prabhupada. So the thing is, you see, even if we knew Sanskrit well enough to read the verses directly, suppose we did, that still wouldn't be enough. Because those verses still wouldn't make sense unless you read all the commentaries of the acharyas that precede us. Sridhar Swami's commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. So, Prabhupada has given us the essence of all those commentaries together. In fact, if you read Prabhupada's commentaries and then you read the commentaries of the acharyas, you can see very clearly that Prabhupada is taking the most essential points from all of these commentaries and putting it in his purports. So therefore, Prabhupada said many times to his disciples, he said, there's no need to learn Sanskrit. I've translated these books for you just so you don't have to. Now, if you want to study Sanskrit, then you want to put in the time and the effort. But it's going to take years, right? Years of work. It's something that a child may do as a future career. But for us, as a hobby, it's not only not feasible, but it can be dangerous. So Prabhupada, whenever his adult disciples asked him, I want to learn Sanskrit, he almost always said, don't do it. Little knowledge is a dangerous thing. You learn the meaning of some word because you can look it up in the dictionary and you say, ah, Prabhupada is wrong. Right? But then you haven't read all the different commentaries. You don't know how the meaning of the word has changed over the different generations. You forget that the Bhagavatam is not using the meaning of the word as found in the Gita, it's actually using the meaning of the word as found in the Rig Veda, right? All those things you cannot know unless you put in a lifetime of study. Prabhupada said, no. But for children, he said they should study Sanskrit because they have the potential to put in the years of effort necessary. So there's definitely a treasure house of meaning in every word. But we're very fortunate that Prabhupada has given that to us. So just reading the translation and purports themselves is sufficient. Not only will you get the meaning of the Bhagavatam, but you'll also get Prabhupada's personal ecstasies. Right? He says, my personal ecstasies are found within these purports. Right? So we understand his own mood. And that's important because we're in his sampradaya. Right? We're his followers. And so we have to, the only way we can understand the Bhagavatam effectively is by understanding it in parampara. And because we're in Srila Prabhupada's parampara, we have to understand how he understands the Bhagavatam. That has to be the lens, the picture through which we see. This is the meaning of parampara. It's like a telescope. You have different lenses lined up so that you look at it and then you can see the sun. You can see the stars. Because all those are lined up nicely. So Prabhupada is there. He's the eyepiece we see him through. And behind him, all this parampara is there. All the lenses are there. So that you can look and you can see that faraway planet, just like this, like it's close by. Other questions? Yes, Prabhu, and then yourself. Yes. See, Krishna's internal energy is present very clearly in Srimad Bhagavatam. But she's not specifically mentioned as Srimati Radharani. And the reason for that is because in order to come to the point of actually understanding Radha Krishna Leela, one has to be very, very advanced. And it is only through the works of the Goswamis that you can come to truly appreciate Radha Krishna Leela, right? And this is why to appreciate Radha Krishna Leela, then we have to go even further to Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. This was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's special contribution. This is why Prabhupada said that Gita is like BA and Bhagavatam is like MA, PhD, and Chaitanya Charitamrita is like postdoc, right? I mean, that's really getting serious. So, everything is there in Bhagavatam, but it's like churning the ocean, okay? When you churn, you churn, you churn, then gradually things come out one after another, you know? You churn milk also, so different things, different stages. Okay, then the butter comes out, then you take the butter and you boil it, make ghee out of it. Then from the ghee, you make different kinds of nice dishes and items, right? Or you take the milk and you condense it, and it becomes nice, thick, and it can become kheer. You condense it more, and it becomes rabri, and then you condense it even more, it becomes khoa, and then you make a barfi out of it. Right? So that's the whole idea. Is you can read Bhagavatam at just a basic level. You can read it at more level, more level, more level. And there's no point in our spiritual life where we will ever stop reading Bhagavatam. Right? Never. It's always there. No matter how advanced we get, Bhagavatam is still an endless source of happiness, of knowledge, of new understandings about Krishna. Okay, you were first Prabhu and then Mataji.
Question. You mentioned the incident about Lord Vishnu shaking hands with Brahma before the creation. I was wondering how this particular incident is viewed from a first place to Mayavad philosophy. Do they think that Brahma would consider form of a Vishnu shaking hand, or do they don't believe in Bhagavatam?
Okay, so the question Vishnu shaking hands with Brahma, this incident, how is it understood by the impersonalists or the Mayavadis? Do they interpret it in a particular way, or what happens? So the specific answer to your question is those verses, aham eva asam eva agre, they would just stick to explaining those verses and not care about the context. The impersonalists generally go out directly and say that the context of the verses is irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference. It's just story. What's really important is the philosophy. And so then they'll take those verses out of their context and then interpret them in a completely impersonal way. And this is one of the principles of our mode of interpretation, that you have to take the direct meaning, the mukhya vritti, the direct understanding that is apparent based on the context of what's being said. Okay, so that's our principle in terms of interpretation or understanding, is we don't take things out of context. We understand them in context and we understand the direct meaning. If I'm standing here and saying, give me water, then you have to take the context in mind. I'm sitting here, I want water, so you're not going to say, let's understand that in an abstract sense. You know, what does he really mean when he says water? Maybe he's thirsting for spiritual knowledge and that's what he's asking. I want water. You understand it directly first. Then you can give other meanings. But the direct meaning cannot be rejected. And that's unfortunately what the impersonalists do, is they reject the direct meaning and they go for the indirect meaning first. But the broader point is that in general, the impersonalists have stayed quite a good distance away from Bhagavatam. There are one or two odd and ends in terms of commentaries, impersonalist commentaries on Bhagavatam. People have tried their hand at it. But it's not a work that you'll find them reading or quoting too much or writing about. Because even up to the Bhagavad Gita, you can twist and turn it. Although already with the Gita, it's difficult. But Bhagavatam, it's like, this is why Bhagavatam is so special for us. It's our turf. And you have to be really, really twisted in order to misunderstand it. Shrida Swami himself was officially, he had taken sannyas in a Mayavad Sampradaya. And yet, even there, he's completely Vaishnav in his understanding, in his interpretation. Right? You just can't do it with Bhagavatam. It just doesn't work. It's so wonderful. And we have, even the Bhagavatam gives so many examples of impersonalists who became devotees within the text. Like Shukadev Goswami was a Brahmavadi. He became a devotee just by reading Bhagavatam. The four Kumaras, impersonalists, they became devotees by reading Bhagavatam. So it has a very dangerous effect on impersonalists. And so they keep their distance. Yes, Mataji. Hare Krishna.
I actually wanted to make a comment. Appreciation that you were describing how Prabhupada's
Yeah.
He's like, go in the parking lots, go in the airports, go wherever you can, right. And give these people stream and project.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the compassion or mercy of a Vaishnava, exactly. That he insists, like you said, not just is open to people coming and learning, but insists that you take this. It's like Vyasadeva running after his son and saying, hold on, I've got something for you, right? It's something very valuable, and you're going to like it. You're going to appreciate it. This is going to make you happy. It's actually the only thing that's going to make you happy, truly satisfied. So please take it. So yes, thank you. That's much appreciated. Before I take more questions, I should mention one thing also, since you go home and wonder where in the world that came from. This last page here, it's curses in the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is actually meant as a handout for tomorrow's 3-5 session. So if you're coming tomorrow, then please bring this with you, okay? If you forget, that's okay. It's not, we can do without it. But it wasn't actually for today. So it may seem a little out of the ordinary. One way it does relate to today's presentation, though, is this is just a handout. I gave a series of lectures earlier this summer in Oxford on the Bhagavatam. They were called Creation and Chaos in the Bhagavat Purana. And part of what we talked about was different kinds of failure in Srimad Bhagavatam. Failure and then the solutions to that failure. Okay, so what we would call fall downs. And then solutions and different kinds. And so part of what we discussed as a result of that was falls due to curses. There's so many curses in Bhagavatam, right? Jain Vijaya, cursed, come down to earth. And Nalukuvera and Manigriva are cursed, they become trees. Daksha is cursed, etc., etc. For that lecture, I did a little analysis of different kinds of curses in Bhagavatam, and then the different responses that the devotees have to those curses. So you have the offensive curse, the defensive curse, reformative curse, predictive curse, and the no-fault curse. And you can find the specific examples of these, you can look up, because I've got those references on the right side. The sages killing Vena is the offensive curse. Right? Daksha curses Narada to wander is a defensive curse, and like that. And then the responses to the curse, you get acceptance of blame from that person. Yes, I'm sorry, it was my fault. Or you reject the blame and you counter curse. Or you reject blame but you accept the curse. I'm not at fault, but it's okay. You're a respected person, I'll accept the curse. Okay. And then what are the effects of that curse? The curse can be redeeming, it can be unfounded. In other words, the person who cursed is at fault, or it can be a catalyst for something that's inevitable. Okay, so we may have time to discuss this more tomorrow. But actually, the session on 3-5 is in one sense a continuation of this seminar. Although it's a different topic, but the main material that we're going to draw from is Srimad Bhagavatam. The topic is talking about different kinds of failure, how we encounter failure in life, and overcoming that failure through dedication, determination, and devotion. Okay? Thank you all very much. Shishi Gornitai ki jai.
So just quickly, just a few quick announcements before we start Aarti. Of course, maybe we'll thank Radhikaraman Prabhu later with our usual way, but we're very grateful again. I just wanted to mention that today's feast actually is sponsored by Santosh and Mamta Mataji, because Aarti started. Maybe they can come forward at the end of Aarti. We'll have a little cake cutting ceremony. This is for Mamta Mataji's birthday, which was yesterday. Tomorrow's program, Prabhuji already announced 3-5, and then we'll have the Sunday feast lecture. Today, after Aarti, we'll do the cake cutting and then Damodarastakam prayers before Prasadam. We're also still looking for sponsors and people who want to help with the cost of the seminars. Any donations for that will be much appreciated. And we have CDs that we can give for anyone who would like to sponsor anything. And finally, after the program tonight, Prashadam program, Om Prabhu is leading the cleanup, so we're very grateful to him. But if anyone else wants to volunteer and assist with the cleanup, that would be very nice. So thank you very much, and now we'll have Aarti. Of course, we already also have full Bhagavatam sets if anyone feels inspired to take a copy of the Bhagavatam home with them. No.
Just a request, if you don't have Bhagavatam yet in your home, then please invite Bhagavatam into your home today. That would be the complete success of this seminar. And if you have Bhagavatam, then find someone you know who doesn't have it and convince them to get a copy.
Jaya Gaura Nitai, Jaya Gaura Nitai, Jaya Gaura Nitai.